energy. And now here is today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with Bridget Vogt and Carol Combs of Starfire, a person-centered provider in Cincinnati, Ohio. But first, disability news for the week of December 16th, 2024. Walmart is piloting a new program to help people with disabilities shop more independently. They're providing free access to visual interpreters at its stores and on its website. The company is partnering with a third-party service app called AIRA, A-I-R-A. The app will connect customers who are blind or visually impaired with sighted interpreters who can give detailed information in real time about their surroundings and help them navigate, read signs, labels, and the like. To use the service, customers stream live video of their surroundings through the AIRA mobile app. Walmart said that interpreters are trained to offer impartial feedback so that users can make independent choices, and they're offering complimentary access to the service so that customers can do just that. Gayatri Agnew, head of Walmart's Accessibility Center of Excellence, said, quote, "The reality is we have tons of shoppers with disabilities who we want to make sure are having as good, if not better, of a shopping experience with us as someone who doesn't have a disability," end quote. In a recent interview on NBC's Meet the Press, President-elect Donald Trump suggested that his nominee to lead the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., would have wide latitude to look into the causes of autism, including investigating the connection between autism and vaccines, which has been disputed by researchers in many studies. The estimated prevalence of autism has increased in the last 25 years from 1 in 150 to 1 in 36 currently, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Experts say the rise is due to improved awareness and identification. Kennedy, however, has spent years blaming the increase in autism on childhood vaccinations. That idea originated from a 1998 study, which has since been retracted. The doctor behind the study had his medical license revoked, and subsequent research has found no link between autism and vaccines. The comments about autism and vaccines contrast with the positions of several autism advocacy groups, like Autism Speaks, the Autism Society of America, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and the Autism Science Foundation, all of which agree with the scientific consensus that vaccines do not cause autism. Kim Machino, Vice President of Public Policy at the Autism Society, said that her group has urged policymakers and leaders to, quote, "prioritize accurate information and scientific integrity in all discussions and decisions affecting public health," end quote. Allison Singer, president of the Autism Science Foundation, said she welcomed interest in studying the causes of autism, but said that revisiting any link to vaccines are misguided. Singer said, quote, "We can't let the discredited vaccine hypothesis become a distraction here. Vaccines are probably the best studied potential cause of autism, and all the studies come back the same. There is no relationship," end quote. And finally, the San Diego Museum of Contemporary Art has recently opened an exhibit to help visitors understand how artists use disability as a theme, a filter, and a subject in their art. The exhibit, titled For Dear Life, Art, Medicine, and Disability, features artworks from the 1960s through the pandemic and touches upon acute illness, hospitalization, car accidents, the AIDS epidemic, mental illnesses, substance abuse, and chronic conditions. It features over 80 different artists. Jill Dawsey, the museum's senior curator, said of the exhibition, quote, "It's a historical show in the sense that it looks backward all the way to the 1960s and is trying to tell this much larger story about American art and these themes," end quote. A 1975 lithograph by Morris Broderson shows a man listening to a flower. Broderson was deaf and studied at the California School for the Deaf. Hannah Wilkie put watercolor and ink flowers on hospital pillowcases while she got treated for lymphoma in New York City in 1992. She died a year later. Other show themes include how illness, disability, and interactions with the healthcare system influence an artist's technique, preoccupations, and politics, how disability brings artists into new communities, how disability serves as a vehicle for exposing, investigating, or celebrating other kinds of otherness, and how artists have sought healing through different pathways, including medicine, alternative therapies, and art itself. With this exhibit, the museum took extra steps to make pieces more accessible. Works are hung lower to help people who are shorter or in wheelchairs without taking away from the experience of taller visitors. It is also using an app called Bloomberg Connects, which has a read-aloud feature that allows vision-impaired people to hear artwork labels. There's also a quiet room designated for visitors who experience sensory overload. The show closes its doors on February 2nd. And that's the news for this week.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills, sketch the trees and the daffodils, catch the breeze and the winter chill.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and I'm Vicki Nicewander. This is Disability Beat. I'm pleased to introduce and welcome Bridget Vogt and Carol Combs, who both are people who work for Starfire, which is a great person-centered provider of services for adults with disabilities in Cincinnati. Welcome to the program, ladies.
Thank you.
So why don't we start out with some introductions. Bridget, I'll ask you to go first. If you could introduce yourself and kind of talk a little bit about what your role is at Starfire, that would be great. And then, Carol, you can follow.
Okay. My name is Bridget Vogt, and I have worked at Starfire for over 20 years in a variety of roles. Starfire works one-on-one with people with disabilities and their families to make connections in their community around their actual neighborhood community, but also their interests and passions that they have. And my role right now is I work with a few people with disabilities doing some of that work with them in their neighborhood. And I'm also a part of our learning network. So reaching out and doing some programs, and training for other agencies and for families around the state of Ohio.
Okay. And Carol, how about you?
So I became connected with Starfire 3 years ago. I am a parent. I have 3 children, and my son Grayson has a disability. So originally my first connection with Starfire was we did a family project. And over the years, I have become a colleague of theirs. So I head up their Family Leadership Network, which is a group of families that support families in building connections in their community with a gift-forward approach. It's families that have gone through the project process, gone through building community, and it's a lot of fun. So that's my current role there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, very good. I'm glad to have a parent on the phone because I, you know, can certainly relate with you. Bridget, talk a little bit about the structure of Starfire and maybe a bit about the history, but I would like to go more into how you determine to provide services in the way that you are, which is on this one-on-one model.
Sure. Well, Starfire has been around since 1993, and during that time it's kind of gone through a few changes. Most significantly was we used to have a day program, and we would have over 80 people with disabilities in our building and a couple different programs, and we just sort of started to learn a little bit. We learned some concepts like SRV. We heard concerns about who knows my child and who will be in their life later. And we really had to take a hard look at what we were doing and kind of perpetuating some of the beliefs about people with disabilities and what was contributing to their loneliness and isolation. So for the past few years, we've just served people in a one-on-one model. So meeting them at their house and really focusing on what it is that they enjoy about their lives and meeting more neighbors and more people that share some of those passions. So I work with a woman who is really good with her hands, and we discovered she's good at sewing on a machine. So what do we do with that, and where can we find more people and connect more around that? So, you know, connecting to the local shop that does sewing lessons and sells the material and has classes, and then creating part of our model, Carol mentioned, like projects. We try to create something for the community around a passion to give people a chance to relate to each other in a different way so that they can kind of build a relationship on how they get to know each other around the person's gifts. Got it. And so if that makes sense.
So you... At one point, you said that you were serving 70 or 80 people in a day program setting.
Mm-hmm.
How many people do you serve now, and is it all one-on-one?
Yes, everyone we serve is one-on-one. So we serve one-on-one through the community building program. And I'm honestly with there have been a lot of changes this past year, as you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
Due to the virus, and shifting from online and virtual and back and forth. So I'm not exactly sure what the number is. So at some point, I think it was close to 50 mm-hmm. people one-on-one. And then we also started the family work and working with families for a few years so that families, no matter what age their children were, but to start a community project as a family. And that, I think, has been about, I think there's about 40 or 50 families that have completed a family project.
Yeah,
and as well.
Maybe Carol, you can talk a little bit more about the family project and specifically, how has the COVID pandemic changed the approach that you use with families?
That's a great question. It's a question we had to explore as a family too, right? So when this all hit, we had built this beautiful community of people where we lived who were supporting us, and it was all in person, and then COVID hit and we had to pivot really hard. We had to do that in real life, and we had to do it with our programming. So for the Family Leadership Network, we shifted everything to a virtual format. So currently the second Thursday of every month, we host a community design session that's virtual, and that's just a space where people can come and start exploring what does it look like to get engaged with neighbors and community, especially during this time. Maybe someone has an idea and they're not quite sure where to begin, or maybe they're interested in building some connections, but they don't know where to start. So, and then we have a storytelling hour once a month, the fourth Tuesday of every month, where we have a family who shares their story of inclusion. Now, COVID certainly has challenged us. For us as a family, our front porch is our favorite space. We're able to see our neighbors, wave, talk safely from a distance. We have families engaging. So in the summer, right now it's wintertime, right? So it's hard to imagine the warmth and the sun and the water. But we had a family do a front yard splash party where everybody on their block, the people who chose to participate, got a pool, and at a certain time they went out in the yard and they had some summer fun from a distance. We had another family in Middletown, Ohio, do a socially distant movie night where everybody kept their distance. They were outside and they were able just to come together and enjoy that space. We've seen families taking on sidewalk chalk art for neighbors, building little libraries, doing little boo bags around Halloween just to let neighbors know. Sometimes it's as simple as just becoming a regular and walking around the block and waving to people. Zoom and technology has certainly helped us a lot during this time. So we have families and individuals connecting on Zoom calls over how they define community through art or history, poetry, video games. So we're seeing families get creative, and we're certainly here virtually to help support them with that creativity.
And Bridget, what are the challenges for you with the work that you're doing with folks one-on-one? Is it mostly on Zoom that you're connecting, or are you actually going out and visiting people?
At this point, we're back to virtual and Zoom and phone calls and video chat. We had a little bit of a window over the summer and early fall where the numbers were low enough that we were back to somewhat normal visiting and going out and talking to people. People are still trying to figure out creative ways just within neighborhoods and walking around. It was kind of during the election. There were some chances of helping putting signs in yards, or not necessarily political ones, but ones of like, that. There was one woman who helped a neighborhood that was just spreading kindness signs. And so there have been different things that were happening. It's in some ways very helpfully, there are a lot of organizations and everyone's trying to find things that you can do outside. So there was an art center that had an artist in residence who would have done one project, but then because no one could come, she made kits to put flowers with certain meaning, whatever the flower had meaning, whatever they are. She had packets and people could make those at their home and then either bring them back to the art center or put them in their yard. So that was one project, or just one thing that people got to be involved in that were connected to the art center. So it just sort of depended on, depending on who's working with who and what neighborhood and what they were already kind of affiliated and connected to, how they could continue. So one woman that I work with and spend time with, she's a regular volunteer at an organization, and we weren't really able to go and sit and volunteer with other volunteers as we usually would. But they would package up the items that she usually prepares for their tote bags that they send out. And she did that from home and then dropped it off so they could still have it. And she's still doing the work with them, but she just couldn't do it with the group of people and the groups weren't going there anyway. And then in the meantime, the volunteers all kind of reached out and shared emails with each other and video calls and things as well. So, but right now we are back to just Zoom calls and whatever creative things we can figure out to do or talk about online. Somebody starting a book club with one of the women they work with, a craft, you get together and talk about your crafts, and a few people are joining on that to stay connected and talking.
Yeah. How about your son, Carol? What's his life like right now?
Life is, we are doing our best to keep him as safe as possible. So a lot of it is that just from a distance. One of the things that's helping is that his sisters and I continue to foster those relationships. My son's nonverbal, so it can be difficult. So we're doing some hand-over-hand art right now. We're preparing for the holidays. What's been great is, when this all happened, we have met amazing people along the way that we just never imagined would enter our lives. So we have people checking on Grayson on a regular basis, and us as a family, because we're in this together, right? So right now, life is good for Grayson. He's surrounded by his family, and we're keeping everybody safely at a distance to keep him as safe as possible.
Hopefully, with the vaccine on the way, we're going to be moving away from the pandemic and into more of what might be considered a normal life, at least for the near future anyway. So as you're, I know that you are very involved with person-centered planning and so forth. I'm thinking that you're not losing sight of those community connections down the road. What are you thinking about as things become available? What are some things that folks with disabilities can do that they can be involved in safely without too much worry of exposure? And either one of you can answer that.
I think no, that's a... Oh, go ahead, Bridget.
Go ahead, Carol. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think for us, the biggest thing has been remembering that community is people in relationship, right? So how can we help Grayson maintain those connections? And we're looking forward to spring and summer and the hope that we can get out. So we're starting to brainstorm what does it look like when we reemerge in the springtime and who are those folks that we can start planning safely neighborhood gatherings and things like that. There's so much unpredictability, but I don't think it's wrong to start planning for when we reemerge from this.
No, I think you're totally right. You need to plan now because you need to have all those plans in place so you can hit the ground running when it's available.
And it's a lot of fun to explore just within the family unit, too. That's how we really discovered our passion for our home, our city of Hamilton. We started internally, and we, within the family, we started interviewing each other about our talents and our interests and our passions and our skills and what could we share. And so that's always a fun way to really start thinking about what does it look like as a family to become more connected.
Yeah, I think a lot of families struggle with that. Everyone's isolated right now, really, yeah. You know, some people more than others. So getting a taste of what it might be like for somebody with a disability who never can get out of their home. Bridget, did you have anything to add to that?
I was just going to say what I definitely, to be person-centered at this point, is pretty easy to see the difference between everyone's perspective of what is safe and what's not. It's not clear. So we've had a lot of discussions as staff and to discuss with people's family and whoever's on their team of support to kind of navigate those questions of, well, what can we do safely and what does feel okay with you, with me? And so it's been interesting, right? There's a pretty wide array of thoughts on that and perspective. So to try to navigate all that. And we're definitely trying to keep those conversations and keep creativity going. Carol mentioned the design sessions of just thinking like, and hearing what other people are doing that is really safe, I think, by everyone's standards. You know, if it's just a porch drop of a gift or writing a note card, and just kind of, it's good to hear what other people are thinking. And it just inspires a little bit more thought and creativity when we're in those sessions with each other. So
seems to me that it would be easier to keep people engaged who had already built that community life. For instance, you know, if you belong to an organization, you could join in on their, you know, Zoom meetings that they have and so forth. But for somebody who's brand new, have you taken in any new clients and worked with them to try and figure out something to keep them, you know, engaged during the pandemic?
There have been a few new faces into Starfire and working with other staff than me, but they've all kind of said, like, it's kind of hard, you know, like it's the difference of an energy if you're trying to get to know someone over a phone call versus if you could be with them and walking and talking and looking at stuff. And, you know, there's a lot more to go on than just a phone call or a video chat. So it is not easy. It's not as easy. But we're trying to just kind of keep things going and do what we can, knowing that this will end and there will be a lot more to explore. But your point is it's very accurate. Like if you already had some pretty solid connections and groups that you, like I mentioned, like the woman, she's already attached to the art center. So she's aware of the fact that they have art kits to make flowers to put in your yard or to bring back. So the more stronger ties, some of the people who've had a pretty strong network when they were struggling because she didn't have a computer, her network of friends and neighbors got together to find an old laptop so she could actually have a Zoom call.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so definitely we've seen some really wonderful stories of strong connections. And I think we're also trying to really be honest with ourselves as staff. Like, there are some weaker connections that maybe this is the time to have a conversation of how much stronger they could, what their involvement, a little stronger involvement in someone's life could mean now and in the future moving forward. So,
yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, if there is somewhat of a connection, exploring that further to see if something else could be built up so that when the pandemic is over, that person has a stronger starting place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one thing I've noticed with my own daughter is that her skill in being able to navigate email and Zoom and all those things has really gotten better. Are you experiencing that with some of the folks that Starfire works with?
Yeah, including myself. I know I have learned a lot more about Zoom. And all these things. I think everyone's comfort level, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So some things I think people will quickly walk away from, and I think some things will continue to happen on Zoom. And that may or may not be like good or bad, I don't know. But I do think there are a lot of people that are figuring it out. There are quite a few technology savvy people that have always understood it pretty quickly. And then there's still some struggles. Like, you know, we definitely, like I mentioned, some people don't have smartphones that we work with or limited Wi-Fi. And that's kind of right. Been some ongoing struggles that we have that I think we're still trying to figure them out and how you can really help and support people when the Wi-Fi is not working. You know, like,
yeah,
what can you do?
Exactly.
And how do you help them still keep connected with people if they can't get a hold of them? Or
yeah,
you thought you had a time set up to meet on Zoom, but then Zoom failed you. So
if there's one thing that you want the listeners to know about Starfire and the work that you do, what would that be?
I think it is the importance that I think everyone right now can definitely appreciate the importance of community and having people in their lives. And Starfire is trying to build that up, that possibility for people with disabilities, in a very respectful and real, authentic way.
I think that sums it up very well. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you to Bridget Vogt and Carol Combs of Starfire in Cincinnati. Thanks for joining me. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
No, down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
This hour of programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by The Canopy Club, hosting live music and events within Champaign-Urbana. The Canopy Club offers a variety of music ranging from rock to electronic, hip-hop, indie, theme nights, and anything in between. Find more information on upcoming events at canopyclub.com or by following The Canopy Club on all social media platforms.
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM Community Radio for East Central Illinois. And did you know there's a brand new way to listen to WEFT? You can still listen, of course, at 91.1 FM on your radio. You can also stream from weft.org, but now you can listen from your mobile phone with the new WEFT app. Available for both iPhones and Android phones, just go to the Apple's App Store or Google's Play Store and search for WEFT FM. Download the app and you can listen to WEFT Live anytime from anywhere in the world. Plus, you can go back and listen to shows in the archives, discover playlists, find community information, make a donation, and even record a message or request and send it directly to WEFT. It's a whole new way to WEFT, and thanks in advance for your support during our winter appeal. And now here is today's episode of Food Sleuth Radio.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate.